Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Torah study. Thank you for joining us. We're glad to be here with you today. I did want to start off this morning. Anyone who is somewhat aware of what's going on in the world around us knows that we have quite a bit going on. There have been obviously storms, there have been earthquakes. I'm not here to preach a gloom and doom, this is the end of the world as we know it, sermon, though that is being proclaimed as well. But I did want to say, you know, it's at times like these that we ought to keep those people in our minds, at least in our hearts and prayers. You know, not only do we have the people who are still dealing with what happened in Houston. I mean, we still have people in Louisiana that aren't in their houses from a year ago. But we have storms that ravaged Houston and southern Texas and Louisiana. Let's not just say Houston. It was really a wide swath there. Florida as well. Puerto Rico, you know, the islands as the storms came through. Many of these places they predict are going to be without electricity for many, 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 you know, weeks and months probably. So don't forget these people. And one of the things, do what? Yeah, the what?
The earthquake
in Mexico, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, we tend to, when one of these events happens, it gets the spotlight in the news, and then we forget about these other groups that just 2 weeks ago had something major happen. You know, I've heard people say, your latest truckload of prayer just arrived, you know, like sort of making fun of that. But prayer is important. There are other ways that we can put our hands and feet to the ground and help people. So look for opportunities to do that. I just wanted to say that, you know, because it is important. That's one of the main reasons that we exist is to help other people. I like to tell people, you might be the answer to someone else's prayer. You know, if you have a way to help, it's not always financial. It could be, you know, any number of things, but think about that. So Shabbat Shalom again. This is a special Shabbat according to the Jewish calendar. it is called Shabbat Shuvah, the Sabbath of return. It's associated, the word shuv means to return. The word for repentance is tied to that word. So you've heard the word teshuvah, which means to turn around, basically. You're going one direction, turn around. So this idea of a Sabbath of return, I really like this. It's a special Sabbath that occurs on the Jewish calendar between the traditional Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In other words, with the sound of the trumpet on Yom Teruah, the traditional Rosh Hashanah, it's believed that we enter into this 10 days of awe leading up to the Day of Atonement. And so it's a time of retrospect. It's a time of where someone will look into their own behaviors and try to set things straight and so forth and make amends. And one of the things that I wanted to start off with before I get into the class today is to read a couple of passages from the prophets that are read in synagogues around the world on this day, on Shabbat Shuvah, whenever they do the Sabbath service according to the annual cycle of readings. So I wanted to read Hosea chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. It says in Hosea 14, verse 1 and 2, "Return, O Israel, to Jehovah your God. You've stumbled because of your iniquity. Take with you words and return to Jehovah. Say to him, take away all iniquity, accept that which is good, and we will render the fruit of our lips." The idea is that you would bring words of repentance and return to God. Make that declaration. You know, it's like you're saying, forgive me for all that I've... Take this iniquity away. And then a couple of other passages. One is from Joel chapter 2, part of which, if you look, I'll just read verse 12. "Yet even now, says Jehovah, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to Jehovah your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and repents of evil. Who knows whether he will not turn and repent and leave a blessing behind him. So this idea, you know, one of the things that I think is important, this, especially this part about, there is this idea that the God of the Hebrew Bible is this vengeful, jealous. Well, those things are scriptural, but don't forget what we just read here in Joel. This passage, gracious, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, that's one of the most oft-repeated phrases describing God. It goes all the way back to Exodus chapter 34. So when people say that, I think, well, you just don't know what the Hebrew Bible says about God. I mean, think about it. That's pretty powerful. Now, there's one other passage that's read. Go with me to Micah chapter 7. In Micah chapter 7, verse 18, who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? He doesn't retain his anger forever because he delights in steadfast love. He will again have compassion upon us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. You will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. You will show faithfulness to Jacob and steadfast love to Abraham, as you've sworn to our fathers from the days of old. So these ideas are read and discussed at this time of year to put forward this general thrust that God is opening the gates, right? And one of the things that I stressed the other night was that the gates of repentance are always open. It's not just in this 10 days of awe, as we call it, but I think it's very powerful and moving when an entire people will focus all of their energies on this idea of repentance. So I didn't want to just, you know, we do our own thing. We do this annual versus triennial. People talk about it. I don't want to lose sight of what the Jewish people are doing, because there is some great teachings and great things that come from that. So just think about that. Now, having said all that, we are now officially in the seventh biblical month. That means whether you are Jewish or you follow very closely the tenets and structure of Orthodoxy, Judaism in one way or another, or whether or not you're looking for the thin crescent moon, which diverges somewhat from the Jewish calendar sometimes, everybody is in the seventh biblical month. Now, the seventh biblical month is called by Josephus, the first century historian, the holy month. So we're in this special period of time, and the fall festivals are upon us. Now, Dave and I, the other night, walked out into the parking lot, and we had a heads up. We knew that 8 hours prior that they had spotted the moon in Israel. So we kind of knew about what time. 8 hours later, at our 7:08 p.m., Dave and I walked out and spotted it. We would have spotted it sooner if you would have been here, Lyndon, because she's usually the one who sees it first. And she's got this really cool app that is sort of cheating. I would say it's sort of cheating. I mean, Moses didn't have that app, I wouldn't think. Oh, he may have. I don't know. Maybe he did. He didn't have, as the joke goes, he didn't have any kind of directional map, you know, on his smartphone. Okay.
City lights to do.
That's right. But so we did spot the moon, and we would say that from this point, that's when the new month is declared, according to this ancient method. Now, the day prior, our friend Yaakov in Hawaii saw it, but he used binoculars. That's a no-go. You have to, I'm joking in case he's listening. But technically, he saw it the day before, which puts things perfectly in line with the Jewish calendar. Right? So it depends on how strict you want to be and how much like Moses you want to be. If you want to be like Moses, like Dave and I, you just use the naked eye. And if you see it, you see it. And if you don't, you look the next night. But it brings up a broader question about, let's call it, the debate on date. You know, people have been fighting over these calendar issues literally for thousands of years. We have records of ancient debates, some of which are contained in religious writings. Some are being mocked by non-religious people. But people argue over these dates so much that there are people who break free from congregational settings because this one's looking for the moon and that one's following the calendar that they received from James Tabor. And I mean, it's just a huge mess. What I want to do is try to bring people beyond that and say, let your conscience be your guide. All right? I'm not going to dictate for you, but I do think that it's important that we recognize these holy days and we seek to live our life accordingly. And I also like the idea of being in concert with the Jewish people personally. Now, that sometimes means that I might have to fast more than other people if I want to be all things to all men, you know, like side with this group and side with that. I've been in a sukkah for 11 days before because I was jiving two calendars, right, Dave? I mean, we've done that. I'm not asking you to put aside your firmly held convictions, but I am asking you to think about how can we come together. That's one of the biggest problems that we've had. So this past Wednesday on the 20th, we followed, according to the Jewish calendar, when they were having their Erev Rosh Hashanah service. We met and we did a Yom Teruah teaching, which is posted on the web. And next week, next Shabbat, according to the Jewish calendar, is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Right now, I'm thinking that on Saturday, next Saturday, I will be teaching on the subject of Yom Kippur as a break from our normal cycle of annual readings. And you say, well, why would you do that? Anciently, they did this too. No matter what the normal Torah reading is, we know this from the Mishnah and so forth, that they would follow the cycle of the seasons and they would talk about the festivals. That those are the first official things that they did in congregational settings. Speaking of Jewish calendars, I don't know if you received yours yet. I don't know. I'll show that later. But this is the United Israel calendar, and these have been mailed out. Some of you may not have received yours yet. I just received my own yesterday. And if you're part of our international membership, I have not yet mailed those. So my intention is to mail these to places like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Europe, Asia. I've got a few people who've asked for these, Germany, and I'll try to get those off next week. So these were made possible by a generous gift from the Trinker family, who've been with United Israel for many, many decades. They were part of it when David Horowitz was first starting it. So they have for many, many decades purchased these. And so they're a free gift, and some people have sent donations in, but it's not required. We want to try to give these as long as supplies last. Then we get down to like five, we'll sell them for a couple of thousand apiece. You want to get yours now. All right. So one other thing about the festivals, October the 1st is a Sunday. We are going to have a fun thing called Build a Booth right here. Dave and I started yesterday or day before drawing up the plans for a super sukkah right outside the building here. And we're going to keep that a secret for you. We've got plans drawn up. We're going to purchase the supplies. And any of you who want to be part of that, this is always fun. We have family. This is good for kids, for young people, for old people, for anybody and everybody. And we're going to build it right here. Now, if you happen to be in the Hickory, North Carolina area, or anywhere close within driving distance there, and it makes more sense for you to go there. United Israel has one of our vice presidents, Dennis Jones, is a rabbi, and his synagogue out there has posted on their website, Temple Beit Shalom. You can Google it, Temple Beit Shalom in Hickory, North Carolina, their calendar of events. So you may choose to go there and celebrate the feast there. But if you're anywhere close to here and you want to come help us put this booth together, show up on Sunday, October the 1st. Now, I'm hoping that we get through this class today because some have predicted that today marks the end of the world. Now, someone on Facebook told me that I shouldn't be joking about this, so look at my face. This is my I'm serious face. I don't think the world's going to end today. But if it does, it's been nice knowing you, and I hope to get through this class because it's important. It's important that we follow the Joseph saga all the way through, and we are now in chapter 40. We are in chapter 40 of Genesis. And so before I get into that text, I want to begin with Genesis chapter 39. Genesis chapter 39. By the way, the reason that I'm not joking so much, but if I took you into the back room here, I could show you about 150 books on my shelves of people's predictions about the end of the world that have come and gone, and here we are. So I like to think, rather than think in those eschatological predictions, I'd rather think about people whose world needs our attention right now. Rather than get into the imaginative, think about people who feel like their world is over already because they've lost everything. So let's keep our orientation right. That's what I mean. Now, Genesis chapter 39 and beginning in verse 20. And Joseph's, this, by the way, is the way that our reading ended last week. It says, and Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But Jehovah was with Joseph, remember that phrase was used four times last week, and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. The keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's care all the prisoners who were in the prison, and whatever was done there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care, because Jehovah was with him, and whatever he did, Jehovah made it prosper. So what we have is Joseph is in charge, seemingly, wherever life puts him. What we tend to know that others might not, because we're familiar with the story, is that the events of his life are ordered. The steps of a righteous man, almost. Think of that. So that even though he may not know that he's been put in a certain place for a certain time as this, that seems to be the case. Wherever he's at, whether he is working in Potiphar's home, whether he finds himself in jail for something that he did not do, he's there, God shows favor, and people around him entrust him, right? So in this case, it says that he's in jail, yes, but into his care are given all the other prisoners. In this particular reading this week, some new people show up at the jail. They are accused of something, whether they did it or not, we don't know. It just says that they came into disfavor. They find themselves in jail. They find themselves under the charge of Joseph. And this is where the story begins to get interesting. I want to read to you today Genesis chapter 40 according to the Transparent English Bible, beginning in verse 1. It's very literal. If you're new here, follow along in your own translation if you do not have this. Chapter 40, verse 1, and it was, after these things, the drink bearer of the king of Egypt and the one baking erred against their master, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two chiefs, upon the chief of the drink bearers and upon the chief of the ones baking. And he gave them into the guarding of the house of the chief of the slaughterers toward the house of the roundness, a place that Joseph was a bound one there. So notice very literal reading for the word that we have typically seen as prison house and so forth, house of roundness. The chief of the slaughterers singled out Joseph with them, and he served them, and they were days, some days in guarding. And they dreamed a dream, two of them, a man his dream in one night, a man according to the opening of his dream, the drink bearer and the one baking who were to the king of Egypt, who were bound in the house of roundness. Joseph came toward them in the morning, and he saw them, and looked, they were upset. And he asked the chiefs of Pharaoh, who were with him in the guarding of the house of his master, saying, "Why are your faces bad today?" And they said toward him, "We have dreamed a dream, and there is none opening it." Joseph said toward them, "Are openings to Elohim? Recount, please, to me." The chief of the drink bearers recounted his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, and look, a vine was before my face, and in the vine were three tendrils, and as it breaking forth, its blossoms went up, its cluster of grapes had ripened. The cup of Pharaoh was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them toward the cup of Pharaoh, and I gave the cup upon the palm of Pharaoh." Joseph said to him, "This is its opening. The three tendrils, 3 days they are. In still 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head and cause you to return upon your position, and you will give the cup of Pharaoh in his hand according to the first judgment that you were his drink bearer. But indeed, remember me with you when it's good to you, and do, please, loyal kindness with me, and cause me to be remembered toward Pharaoh, and cause me to go out from this house. For I was really stolen from the land of the Hebrews, and also here I've done nothing that they should place me into the pit." The chief ones baking saw that he opened good, and he said toward Joseph, "Indeed, I saw in my dream, and look, three baskets of white bread on my head, and in the top basket were some of all eatable things of Pharaoh, done of one baking, and the birds were eating them from the basket from upon my head." Joseph answered and said, "This is its opening. The three baskets, 3 days are these. In still 3 days, Pharaoh will lift your head from you and will hang you upon a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from upon you." And it was on the third day, the day of being brought forth of Pharaoh, that he made a drink feast for all his servants and lifted the head of the chief of the drink bearers and the head of the chief of the ones baking in the midst of his servants. He returned the chief of the drink bearers to his drink bearing, and he gave the cup upon the palm of Pharaoh, and the chief of the ones baking he hanged as Joseph had opened to them, and the chief of the drink bearers did not remember Joseph, and he forgot him. Now, sort of a short story, the Reader's Digest version, but what we have here is Pharaoh puts these people into the prison house, and they're going to stay there. And if you notice the literal reading, it said, on the day of Pharaoh's being brought forth, this is like a birthday party, right? It's the day of his being brought forth. Birthday parties have been around for a long time. Now, some people, some brands of Christianity don't celebrate birthdays because it's like every time they read about a birthday party in the Bible, it's a bad thing, right? Now, this being one, if you're into the Christian scriptures, you think of John the Baptist, you know, and what happened at that party and so forth. So, but nonetheless, we are talking in the Joseph saga. And one of the first things that we learn about Joseph is that Joseph is a dreamer. I want you to go with me to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37. I just want to cover, we're going to be talking a little bit about dreams over the next few weeks or the next few readings. So we need to begin to understand biblically what we know about dreams. All right. So in chapter 37, verse 5 through 11, I just want to recount these dreams. Now, one of the things that I want to let you know, I'm not going to get ahead of us on the dreams. I'm not going to talk about dreams that happen later in our story in Genesis, because that would spoil the fun. But I will go back and pick up some of these other ideas. Genesis 37:5, Joseph had a dream. He told it to his brothers. They only hated him the more. I just want you to remember that. This is what his dreams got him into. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" So they hated him yet more for his dreams and for his words. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I've dreamed another dream, and behold, the sun, the moon, the 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come down to bow before ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. All right. What we have is Joseph, when we first meet with him, he's a dreamer. And the question becomes, does he know what they mean or not? Now, the brothers tend to pick up on, at least based on what we just read, they seem, it's almost like Joseph doesn't even know what he's saying. Hey guys, what do you think this means? We're all sheaves in this dream. My sheaf is standing up big and tall, and your sheaves are like laying on the ground, like bowing down to mine. What do y'all think that means? Right? I mean, this is kind of the way the story presents it. And they hate him for this. They want to kill him. They hate him more. They already hated him. So then he has another dream. Now, notice what they see as the interpretation. It's almost like the meaning is obvious. Do you get that? Like, I mean, if I told you that dream and said, "I had that dream, guys, my sheaf stood upright and all yours were bowing down to me," you don't have to be very much into dream interpretation to try to say, "I guess you're saying that yours is more important than mine," right? There's not a lot of symbolism there. I mean, once you get past the fact that we're all a sheaf of wheat, the rest of it's pretty easy to crack, right? No need for a wise man from the east. So, but they pick up on right away that Joseph is suggesting that he's going to be exalted and they're not. So too does Jacob. One of the reasons I bring this up is these dreams don't require a lot of insight to interpret. Everybody follow me on that? Now look at chapter 37, verse 19. When they see him coming, this is later in the story, verse 19, verse 18, they saw him afar off, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another, "Here comes the dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that the wild beasts have devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." The dreams are what caused them to hate him. In the Hebrew, he's called Baal HaChalamot, the Lord of the dreams. The brothers call him the Lord of the dreams. The master of the dreams. You could say dream master. In fact, I like that title. As they see him walk, you can imagine the brothers and they're like, "Oh, here comes the dream master." the dream master. Let's kill him, throw him in a pit, and we'll see what happens as a result of his dream. Well, guess what? They are indeed going to see what happens, what comes of his dreams. That's a fact. Okay, now one point. If you look at chapter 37, verse 28, you just heard me mention the pit. All right? This word pit is going to come back into our story today. So I want you to think about Joseph in the pit. So if we look at verse 28 of 37, Midianite traders passed by and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels. All right, and if you go down to later in the story, I won't pick this one up. I don't know exactly where it's at. The idea is that Joseph finds himself in a pit. All right, now keep this in mind because it's going to show up again later. Now, if you go to chapter 40, where our story begins today, verses 1 through 4 basically say that the drink bearer and the baker, the one over the baking ones, find themselves in jail. According to rabbinic tradition, there are all sorts of understandings as to what put them there. You know, that when you spend all your time in the Bible, you have time to speculate and so forth. So I'm talking extra biblical. Some say that there was an accusation that they had tried to poison the Pharaoh. Some said that he discovered a fly in his food. But for whatever reason, they fall into disfavor with the Pharaoh. You can imagine that that would not go well. So they end up in jail. They end up under the charge of Joseph. Now, they dreamed. The both of them dreamed a dream in the same night. Like, sleeping in their cell. And I don't know what that looked like at the time, whether it was a round building and everyone was in there together, whatever the case may be. They have a dream, both of them, and it just so happens that they have among their co-prisoners the Dream Master. But they don't know this. And what they do is they both wake up very troubled. They must have been troubled because, you know, it indicates that they looked very troubled. And so Joseph asked them what it is that troubles them. But we're going to take a pause in the story, and I want to talk just for a few minutes about dreams in the ancient world. What do we know about dreams in the ancient world? Now, a couple of points that I find interesting. Most of us at one time or another have had dreams. I mean, you know, some dream and recall their dreams more frequently. Some can only recall a few dreams. Personally, for me, very seldom do I remember my dreams. But some find great significance in their dreams, and they remember many, many details and so forth. I have people very close to me who have many, many dreams, and they write them down, and they have meaning. But what does the Bible say about dreams? And I wanted to hit a couple of passages. If you'll go with me to the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12, verse 6. Now this, in context, God is talking. So you just so you know, he's talking to Miriam, Aaron, and Moses are together. And he said, "Hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, Jehovah, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream." Okay? So the idea that God can communicate to people through the dream is what's stated very clearly here. So how does that happen? In other words, what examples? Here it's just stated sort of matter of fact, that if there is a prophet among you, I'll speak to him, make myself known to him in a vision, speak to him in a dream. Now, then there's this statement which follows that says it wasn't like that with Moses. With him, I speak face to face. Different case with Moses, right? But we're talking about prophets in general. Remember, the writer of Deuteronomy wants us to understand, Deuteronomy chapter 34, that there has not arisen a greater prophet than Moses in Israel, whom the Lord knew face to face, right? So Moses, according to the biblical writers, is at a level greater than your prophet. But generally, a prophet is communicated to in the dream world. It's one method. So if you go with me to 1 Samuel chapter 28, I just want to show you that this was considered a method whereby, 1 Samuel 28, whereby God would communicate. Or not, as the case may be. So look at 28, verse 6. And when Saul inquired of Jehovah, Jehovah did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim, you know, the Urim and the Tumim, or by prophets. So the writer of 1 Samuel presents that these three ancient methods whereby God might communicate, dreams, Urim, or prophet, none of them were working. Saul has no way of hearing from God. That's what we're trying to convince here. That's what the writer wants us to understand. But there is quite a bit, actually, in the Hebrew Bible that talks about God communicating through dreams. And we've already covered some in the book of Genesis so far. So if you remember in Genesis chapter 28, verses 9 and following, when Jacob is leaving and going to Paddan Aram, he has this dream of the ladder and so forth. And in that dream, God speaks to him. And he talks to him about his descendants and how he's going to go with him into the along his journey, and he'll bring him back, and your seed will be scattered from the west to the east, to the north, to the south. But God's talking to him. Now, when he wakes up, he recognizes it. You remember the story. But there is no doubt, according to Genesis 28, that that is a piece of divine communication. And it makes it very clear that it comes during sleep, right? It says very, very straightforward, and he put his head on a rock and went to sleep. And it says, and he dreamed, and behold, a ladder. Everybody clear there, all right? There's also the story in Genesis 31, verses 10 through 13, where Jacob is telling the girls, his women, how God communicated to him in a dream about the mating flocks and all. So there, the message is that the dream was a way whereby God could bring wealth, if you will, to his people. According to Genesis 31, Jacob says, you know, God gave him this idea. Now, that's the kind of idea we all want, right? How is it that I can get rich? Give me that dream. That's what I want, right? But this is what the story conveys, that God's talking to him while he sleeps. Now, the point that I wanted to make leading into today's story is, according to the Hebrew Bible, it's not just the Hebrews who have these dreams where God speaks to them. See, some might say, well, you know, the Hebrews are special and God talks to them in dreams, and if you're not Hebrew, God can't talk to you in a dream. Well, that's not true. And then you might take it further and say, well, maybe he talks to these people, but they need a Hebrew to interpret. Not really. Well, let's just think about it. So what do we know? Who else had dreams in Scripture? If you think back, we had Avimelech, has a dream in chapter 20 of Genesis, and God basically tells him, the woman that you have, Sarah, give her back or I'm going to kill you. Now, let me ask you something. If you don't know how to interpret dreams, what do you think that means? Right? Anything difficult about it? Now, I don't see that there were pictures of stalks of grain or anything like that. It's like in this dream, Abimelech hears, take that woman and get her out of your house and give her back to that man. He's a prophet. He'll pray for you and he'll heal you. Otherwise, I'm going to kill you. That's pretty much the dream. So he wakes up and he says, I got to get this woman out of my house. Nothing difficult about it. So far, right? Is pretty straightforward. Dreams are a way to communicate, not a bunch of imagery, not a bunch of difficult, you know, mystical, what does this mean kind of thing. What about Laban? Remember, Laban has this dream, and basically God tells him, don't mess with Jacob. Remember, he chases him down and he tells him, look, I was warned in a dream not to mess with you. Again, any difficulty understanding? No. Just a direct mode of communication. Now, when most people talk about dreams and dream interpretations, they get into a certain almost scientific approach, and we have all these different symbols. Like I have friends of mine who go, man, I dreamed last night that I was wearing a green scarf. And it was flowing in the wind, and it got hung on a tree, and, you know, this happened, and this, and I saw an apple fall. And then they'll go on the internet, and they'll type in Google. I just made that up, by the way. And they'll say, green scarf blowing in the wind. And somebody has said that that means you're going to come into a bunch of money or whatever. So what I want to do is distinguish between what's going on in our stories. What's real, and I'm not a master. I'm not a dream master. I know a dream master. I'm not a dream master. But in our story, we enter into something different this week, something a little bit different. So far, none of these dreams that we've talked about have required an interpretation. It's not like the dreams are sealed in their meaning and people go, I wish I knew what that meant. Now, in biblical literature, there are those, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. We get more into it in coming weeks, where you do need someone to open that which is sealed. All right? And we're going to get into that more in another. But so far, we hadn't had that. Now, Joseph sees on their faces that something is wrong. And he says, what's the matter, guys? Why is your face bad today? Can you imagine telling somebody that? You know, the very literal. Gee, Mark. Yeah. Gee, Mark, why is your face so bad today? And you're like, well, I didn't know it was so bad. Thanks. I have had people say, man, you look like you need some rest. What does that mean? That's like, it's like saying, man, you look like hell today. But people do sometimes do that. So that's kind of what he does. He said, why do you look so bad today? Well, because they were tossing and turning all night, right? And let's look at Genesis chapter 40. Genesis 40. And I'm just going to read verse 6 through 8. When Joseph came to them in the morning and saw them, that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, why are your faces downcast today? And they said to him, we have had dreams and there is no one to interpret them. Right? So they had dreams that weren't so straightforward. It wasn't like, do this or I'll kill you. It was, it in some ways, there were symbols. There were numbers. There are three vines, three tendrils, and there were grapes, and I was mashing the grape, and it poured into the goblet, the cup, and I gave it into the hand of Pharaoh, and, you know, what does that mean, see? He didn't know. The other one dreams of these wicker baskets, you know, and bread, white bread, in the basket, and birds pecking through the side and eating it, you know. And he's like, what does that mean? You know, so they didn't know. Well, in Hebrew, there is a word that is translated here, interpret. If you look at the Transparent English Bible, James translates a certain word open, opening, and so forth. This word occurs 14 times, the Hebrew word. The root is pei, tav, resh, petar. All right, variations on that word occur 14 times in Scripture in 11 verses, only 11 verses, only 14 times. Get this, only in Genesis chapter 40 and 41. Nowhere else in the Bible. Okay? Now, 40 and 41 of Genesis cover the Joseph cycle of readings. And it's about dreams, and it's about dreams specifically in Egypt. So I started thinking, what does that word mean? You know, it's translated interpret to open. Is there something else that I can find? And I began to look and I began to search. And it basically does in every... I have quite a few academic sources here. It means to interpret, to solve, and thus to open. It's like if you had something that was closed and sealed, and you were able to open that up and look into it, that's the idea. All right, so I found this word, the root word, patar. Patar is the root word. Again, only in chapter 40 and 41 of Genesis. now, there's a related word, sometimes. Now, don't go wild with this because I'm studying this. You can study it too. I'm no smarter than anybody that I'm talking to. But some people go crazy with substituting letters. You know, like Hebrew is built generally on three root letters. Sometimes if you change one of the root letters, it's similar or it means something else, and people get into all kind of whacked out stuff. So I'm telling you, don't do that. But in Hebrew, the pei, the tav, and the resh, which means to interpret, is very close in meaning to another word which has a similar spelling but a substituted middle radical, it's called. A pei, a sheen, and a resh. And a pesher is sort of an interpretation. So, for instance, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found, not we, like I wasn't there, but scholars, archaeologists found... there were certain scrolls that were discovered that are called Pesherim, which are interpretations, like the Habakkuk Pesher, where it is say, this is what the verse says and this is what it means. So these related ideas, this idea of opening up the meaning, very much related. Now, in a very similar vein, I did find in the theological word book of the Old Testament, which is a very good classic work on meanings of these words, there is this idea that's mentioned. Go with me to Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22 and verse 5. Numbers 22, 5. And it says... Now, this is about, you know, the Balak, Bilam, Balaam. And then, let's see, verse 5. Let me back up. So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to Bilam, the son of Beor, at Petor, which is near the river in the land of Ammah, to call him, saying, behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the land of the earth and so forth. There is a reference in the scholarly works that I was looking at yesterday that suggests that this word, petor, see, it's very similar to patar. And it says, the suggestion by some of the scholars is that this particular word is assumed to be the location that Balaam's from, but they propose that it's actually his title, that Balaam was an interpreter. He was one who could open the meaning. He was one of these people, and that's why they went and sought him out. Whether that's the case or not, this is the only time that this place is ever mentioned in biblical literature, if it's a place. So the question becomes, who is one who can open the secrets? And that's what these men need to know, and that's where Joseph comes into our story today. Now, again, back in Genesis chapter 40, verse 8, in chapter 40, verse 8, the English says, they said to him, "We've had dreams and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to him, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me." All right? Interesting. Now, just reading that, we might get into more of this in the dialogue, but he basically says, "Lelohim pitronim," in Hebrew, to God, or for God, Lelohim pitronim. It's translated interpretations or openings. In other words, openings belong to God. That's why these translations are trying to convey that general idea. Whether it says, don't interpretations belong to God, give it to me. Well, why would I give it to you? Right? You said it belongs to God. What are you going to go? Notice, according to the narrative, that he says the interpretations belong to Elohim, give it to me, and then he immediately tells them what it means. Now, these are questions that I have. We'll talk about this in the dialogue. In other words, is he getting it as it unfolds? And if so, how? He must truly be the dream master, right? Now, the first dream, he says, tell it to him. So the cupbearer goes first. He tells his dream. Joseph gives him a favorable opening. Tells him, yeah, okay, well, the three tendrils that you saw represent 3 days. The fact that you're squeezing grapes into the cup and you put it into the palm of Pharaoh's hand, you're going to be restored. Then he uses a phrase, lift your head. Now, biblically, to lift the head, its basic meaning is often associated with a census. All right? So if I were taking a count in a room full of people and I'd say, okay, lift up your head, it's 1, 2, 3. In other words, you're counting, see? So a census is when you lift the head. If I'm trying to figure out how many people are at a conference or something, and you have people in the back and they've got their head down, you want to say, hey, pick your head up in the back there. I need to see everyone. See, the idea, then it's going to prove to be a play on words here in the text, in the opening of the dreams. Joseph says he's going to lift your head. In other words, when he counts his servants, you're going to be there. Does that make sense? You're going to be in the back, maybe, but you're going to be there. Everybody lift your head. Okay, I see you back there, the cupbearer, the baker, the candlestick maker. I got everybody here. All right? So that's the idea. Now, what happens is, actually, look at verse 14, chapter 40 and verse 14. He says this. Joseph says, after he gives him the favorable opening of the dream, he says, remember me when it's well with you. Like when you get restored, you're going to get restored. I just saw it. I got this idea coming. You're going to be restored. When you are, and it goes well with you, don't forget me. Remember me. And do me the loyal kindness. Do chesed. Right? What is hesed? That's one of the key biblical words, one of the great biblical Hebrew concepts. Loving, kindness, loyal, true loyalty. It really, it's not confined to a singular definition. It indicates this loyalty is steadfast, right? Steadfast love. So he tells him, don't forget me and do loyal kindness to me, I pray you, to make mention of me to Pharaoh and to get me out of this house. He wants out of jail. And he's thinking, look, if you get out of here and you go and you, I want you to tell the Pharaoh, hey, there's this guy and he had this dream. And, you know, it's, I'm so glad to be back, Pharaoh. You know, I didn't put the fly in your cup after all, and I'm glad you got me out of here. But, you know, this Hebrew's the one that told me about this because I had this dream. And, you know, he doesn't do any of that. Joseph wants him to, but he doesn't. Not yet, anyway. Now, look at verse 15. He said, for I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I've done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon. Now, if you read the English here, you get the idea that Joseph is commiserating with these prisoners, and, you know, I don't, you know, I know that there are people in prison who are there through no fault of their own. People have been falsely accused. But that's the old, it's almost a joke, and I don't mean to make fun, but, you know, everybody in there is innocent. You know, I was framed. I was set up. In many cases, it's true. What he's saying is I'm one of those. I did nothing to be put in this dungeon, if that's what it says in Hebrew. But he's talking. Now, my question is he talking about the dungeon? Well, first of all, the word dungeon isn't there. That's not what the Hebrew says. He's telling them a story that led him to this place. He says this. I've done nothing that they put me into the pit. Remember, he said, I was stolen from the land of the Hebrews. Now, whether he's talking about the dungeon as the pit, or he's referring back to the first pit he got thrown in, hear me, the word is the same. So what we want to see, though, is that Joseph once again is referring to being thrown into the pit. Remember when we read this in chapter 37, if you look just to have it in your notes, verse 28. 37:28. The Midianite traders passed by and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit. See that word bore? It's like a well or a pit. It's a dugout place. And that's what he's saying. They, who is they? They threw me in this pit. I didn't deserve it. All right. Now, the baker, he's listening to all this evidently. And it's almost, you get the impression, he's like, oh, do me. I had a dream too. You know, he's excited because he just heard that the cupbearer is getting restored. And the baker said, "And okay, I got one too." He's excited. He also had certain imagery of, he had the three, right? For the cupbearer, the three represented 3 days. In 3 days, you're going to be, well, he had three too. The cupbearer dreamed of wine because he's a cupbearer. And he just heard that you're going to get your job back. He's thinking, I dreamed about bread. And I'm a baker. But there's a twist. So what Joseph uses a turn on the same phrase to lift the head. You're both going to be counted. In 3 days, you're both going to be in accounting. The cupbearer is going to have his head lifted and he'll be restored. The Hebrew uses a slightly different phrase for the baker. It says, your head will be lift your head from you. That didn't sound good. right? It's almost, the language would imply a beheading. It's to take your, it's one thing to lift your head. Lift your head up, Dave. Mm-hmm. But if I say, I'm going to lift your head from you, you might say, I'm not sure that the semantics isn't coming in, but when you say you're going to lift it from me, what exactly, see, it's a difference, right? So that's the play on the Hebrew. The symbology in some ways is the same. It involves what they did. It involves the number of days until this is going to take place. And it's a turn on the Hebrew, so you have to really pay attention. Lift the head from you. Indeed, this is what happens. The cupbearer is restored, and the baker is killed because his dream means that the birds are going to pick your flesh. It's really a bad dream. It's a bad dream, and it comes to pass. Today's reading contains two dreams. This, if you didn't notice this, this is the second of three sets of dreams which are instrumental or pivotal in the life of Joseph. Do you notice that? Three sets of dreams. The first two were the dreams that he had and told his brothers. The second two are the dreams of others in the prison. And then the third will be covered in the next class. Now, each of these pairs of dreams are interesting when we talk about the development of the dream master. In the first one, we're really not sure if Joseph knows what they mean. We think it's pretty obvious, though, right? I mean, you and I can look at it and figure this out. I'm not trained as a dream interpreter. Oniromancy. Oniromancy is the word. I posted this on Facebook. That word means the interpretation of dreams. You can look it up. O-N-E. Oniromancy. But the dream interpretation isn't really needed in most of these dreams. Now, later it is, but one of the things that is important for us, especially, like when I get into the Genesis 41, I'm going to make some associations with the prophet, with the book of Daniel, and I'm going to tie some things together. But one of the things that I want people to recognize is, especially those who love to study prophecy, is quite often people get into their own interpretations as to what these things mean. And I have plenty of books which are witness to this kind of thing. You know what blows me away? A lot of times in the story itself, it'll say its meaning is this. But it's not what people use. They're like, no, this means this, this, and this. And you're like, what, did you read the chapter? I mean, it says it means this. So anyway, be careful with your interpretations. Where an interpretation is pretty obvious, you know, such as give the woman's, the man his wife back or I'll kill you, don't look for a whole lot of different meaning there. Just get the woman back. If this applies to any of you, I would suggest you do that. But generally, people tend to go further than what they need to. Look in the text, first of all. Now, just as a reminder, those first two dreams that Joseph has that he reveals to his brothers, they almost get him killed. But they ultimately end up with him in a pit, which brings him to Egypt. I think that we're not finished with those dreams yet, is what I'm saying. We're going to go back to those two dreams. Jacob does seem to get it, though. You know, remember he says, I'll put these things on hold for a while. According to chapter 40 and 41 of Genesis, the openings belong to God. They're made known to us in our story through Joseph. This is going to be important for later classes. Joseph is the dream master, the Lord of the dreams. Shabbat shalom.